Welcome to the Productivity Podcast. Sue returns and we continue our talk on the book, Every Second Counts. We're on to chapter three. Chapter three, how can I make savings? So I think we'll start by kind of with the white elephant in the room. So savings has a bad reputation in terms of the word. Lots of people will think that means slash and burn approach to taking money out and reducing jobs and just doing it kind of without any logic or thought process. But that way damages your customer experience. And we've seen organisations where they've done that in the short term and actually it's kind of cemented, unfortunately, where they end up in the long term in terms of their ability to operate. So sounds like desperate measures. Sometimes it is. But in a responsible and planned way, like you do with your own finances, like you do just in your own life, there's a diligent way to do it that means you can extract some value, invest that elsewhere, maybe do a bit of both. And that's what this chapter's all about, Sue. So it's not saying slash and burn and just take a load of cost out and that's the way to do it.
Absolutely. It's about kind of the positive side of saving costs. Because it's something that all businesses and organisations have to do because there's always new things you want to spend your money on. So that might be extra pay rises for the whole team. It might be some new IT technology that's coming along, or it might be a new product development or a new service that you want developed that requires some money freeing up to support it. So really it's about the best way to do it is that kind of little and often. So if you're constantly reviewing your operational costs and where you're at, so you've got a regular plan for doing it, it's much easier. If you go along and think everything's okay and let it just run for 5 years and then start to try and do things, it's kind of a much bigger challenge. And culturally, the organisation just isn't used to that sort of change. You know, we live in a world that's changing rapidly all the time. And if our operation isn't changing in tune with the customer and environmental and technical changes that are around us, you reach a point where at some point you have to make a hard stop and make some difficult decisions.
And I think one of the things maybe that wasn't on your list, which I think is impacting everybody's national living wage. So even if you're not doing the exciting stuff, the cutting edge stuff in your organisation, I guarantee you'll still be challenged by national living wage, which is meaning everybody's going around this loop. There's also a reason why it's called continuous improvement, because yeah, the cycle never stops. And I think it's fair to put out there that the worst way to deliver savings is this blunt percentage cost approach.
Yeah.
And I get it. I see it a lot. And from a business case point of view, a rough assumption that if we do this, we'll save or spend X percent on salaries. A fine working assumption, but then you need to validate it. And you also need to be prepared then if you're way off the mark. I mean, less so now, but I'd say probably since COVID up until maybe the start of this year, the amount of organisations we've worked with, spoken to, where there's been assumption laid on assumption laid on assumption because of COVID, because of the way that, you know, click and collect, home delivery, picking's changed, that almost the base is completely wrong. So they're having to rebase everything to truly understand where they're at, because the assumptions are so far out, and some positively, some negatively, that it just doesn't smell or feel or have any resilience or backbone to the numbers anymore. And once you lose that and you can't stand behind it, you kind of on a bit of a downward spiral.
Yeah. And there are some organisations that can make that straight 10% cut without damaging it. So if you're an organisation that's been running kind of quite heavy in terms of resourcing, and you know you're significantly over-resourced versus what you need, you probably can get away with doing a 10%. You can't keep on doing it.
And there's lots that are close to the bone now, aren't they? So
yes,
that luxury of having a buffer in your salary budget to be able to do that's been eroded, and it will be eroded even more in the next couple of years as national living wage continues to rise, cost will settle, but we're still going to face that headwind of cost pressure.
Yes.
So from kind of the way we do some stuff, and we've talked about it before in the efficiency study episode we did last year, we tend to split things into kind of three broad categories: so customer facing, stroke value adding time, essential task and processes, and then downtime. And that really helps Sue from benchmarking across organizations, from benchmarking outside organizations, and starts to give you, when you get the data and James and the team, the ability to do some creative insights.
Yes. And for a client receiving that data, it can be the first time they might have had a suspicion that perhaps we're spending a bit long on admin, or perhaps we've got a bit of slack time first thing in the morning, or it confirms all those suspicions. So, and then it uncovers new stuff. There's always new things to find. So actually it gives people a really good basis for some sensible and evidence-based decision making.
And even splitting within an organisation, so a high street versus a retail park versus a regional shopping centre, there can be some really key insights by day of week, time of day, especially as you move from high street to regional shopping centre, where you might have that more leisure evening trade, weekend trade, versus a high street, which would typically be your 9 till 5 trade, matched then to your staffing profiles to understand how much downtime that creates or doesn't.
Well, going back to your point about, in some instances, workload models not matching reality anymore, there are some businesses that have never started from a workload model. You know, they've got a historical way of doing things and they've stuck with it. The other good thing that an efficiency study shows is what's the difference between your sites. So that's something that applies to all sectors, because you can start to see, have you got one location that's really kind of got no downtime at all, is really struggling, is running much harder than other sites. So it allows you to understand what's the variation across my sites, and kind of it creates a case for, well, we need to look at workload modelling, because it looks like we've got more fat in one place than we have in another. And actually, it can, in some places, if you're running too tight, it can actually, you know, stop your business growing. So you reach a point where either quality is affected, or, you know, customer experience, if it's a business that's got customers in it, there's something, or your colleague morale and satisfaction goes down. So somewhere along the line, if it's too tight, then it's then the business is impacted. So being able to save costs somewhere else is really important, so you can move your money around and get the best impact for the business from it.
And that's amplified even more if you've got a multi-brand or multinational operation. So you've got different countries or different brands within your organisation. There's always that strive for consistency. So one of the things that people like in the book, and we've had some good feedback, is about the quick wins. So in chapter 3, in terms of quick wins, so potential quick wins that reduce cost and also good for long-term planning, we've got operational cost lines that aren't salary related, such as goods not for resale, bags, clean materials, uniform, paper costs. So again, length of till receipts, so they in line with what the market's doing. Actually, do you need them at all? Lots of people moving to email and then storing that information in their loyalty apps. Again, I remember my time in stores, uniform, it was kind of about how do you spend the budget by the end of the year. So everybody used to have stacks of uniform in the store. We'd run out throughout the year, then we'd have stacks at the end of the year, so we kind of didn't really manage it well.
Even without that, there can be instances where if it's not gone out to tender for a while, you know, those sorts of hidden costs can go a bit under the radar. So even in a business that might be red hot on most of their buying and negotiate margins hard, if goods not for resale sits in a different part of the business, it can be it doesn't have that same scrutiny in terms of, you know, buying, and it might be time to just renegotiate.
Yeah. Energy costs, clearly been a hot topic over the last 12 months and will continue to be so. Again, staggered at times by, you know, certainly in the autumn and winter periods of the year, how after Sunday closing, late in the evening, you'll go past shops, all the lights will be on.
Yeah.
Used to be a bugbear of mine, garden centre floodlights being left on overnight. So, yeah, I get it. It's tricky. But again, have the local stores, or if it's controlled centrally, have the timers been reviewed? Are we sure that we're not lighting it for nobody's sake or heating it for nobody's sake? Because that's that is literally just throwing money down the drain. And yeah. And I could probably take anybody listening to this podcast in September, October. We could get in the car at 8 o'clock at night and drive down High Street in any town, and after they've closed in a retail park, and we'd find handfuls of examples where that happens. Handfuls.
And when you look sort of off, if you're talking in retail and kind of customer-facing worlds, if you look at kind of the off-sales floor bits off, you know, up, that's away from the front of house, things like having lights that are triggered by movement help. So, you know, the number of times corridors or stairwells or, you know, a stock area is lit, you know, and it's easy to leave the light on. Whereas if you have something that just triggers it when the light comes on, it's so much easier. And the number of times you'll see, like, stock areas being heated. I think historically, where you perhaps would have had more people doing manual checking off of stock, you would have needed heaters because you've got people in there all the time. If all that happens is somebody, you know, pops in, dumps a load of stock on a shelf quickly and then goes back onto the shop floor, do you really need it to be heated to 20 degrees?
Yeah. High stock holding. So again, you've got to see the bigger picture. So sometimes there might be a reason why there's lots of certain lines of stock. There's a rebate that becomes centrally, so it's more attractive. But clearly, the more stock you're holding in each location, the more cash you're tying up. And what we tend to see is the more stock there is, the more times it gets touched. So it might get dragged onto the floor 5, 6, 7, 8 times before it actually goes on the shelf and fits, if you've not got kind of intelligent stock management. So that's a real cost in terms of the cost of the stock.
It's fascinating when we've done study work looking at, if you look at the number of items that we see put to shelf versus the numbers that go into the stock room, there's quite a big variation. So some people will have less than 10% of their delivery that doesn't fit to shelf and therefore has to go out the back, whereas others we can see kind of approaching half of it. And it's where you can sometimes get decisions within silos within an organisation. So that might have been a brilliant decision for the in terms of trucking costs, but actually there's a hidden cost in terms of the amount of extra work it pushes into the stores.
Yeah, and every time you touch it, you're losing money.
Yeah.
Other than the first touch that goes out. Opening hours. So again, we've seen probably people condense those. Maybe they become more seasonal. So maybe you open longer in the summer, depending on where you are and what your customers are looking for. Maybe you open shorter hours in the winter as the nights close in, depending on your offer. And again, some of that's been linked back to availability of resource in some organisations, and in others, a way of cutting cost. You don't necessarily reduce the work because you'll still have the same inbound deliveries, you'll still have the same admin, et cetera, but you just condense it into a shorter window. And the same can be said for operating hours. So again, I think most people have cut back on nights other than the really big supermarkets. Twilight still exists, early still exists. But is there a way of getting that work done more effectively, bringing the tasks into the operation in quieter parts of the day?
And when you've got fresh items being delivered, obviously you have to work them within a certain time window unless you can kind of put them into some refrigerated unit. But generally, you know, if your delivery arrives at 6 o'clock in the morning, can you just leave it until later in the day, you know, or can you have an afternoon delivery and then you just leave it until the next day to work it? You know, there can be, there's restrictions on delivery times in certain, you know, certain councils and certain areas of cities and that sort of thing. But actually, there's probably a lot you can do that you don't have to put a delivery away the instant it's delivered. You can just leave it until you can have a much better operating model.
Yeah, other than your chilled stuff. But yeah, everything's got out a window. And again, we've talked around, you know, hourly cost rising. So can you outsource? People outsource, you know, have been for longer than can I remember, cash counting and banking to make it more cost effective, as certainly as we see kind of cash going through that cycle of decline and then rise. How can you outsource that? Phone calls to central teams. Lots of people have streamlined recruitment now and kind of automated so that there's less involvement at a local level until it gets to a screened candidate that ticks lots of the criteria. And then managing costs by managing your kind of investment profile. So that can be holding back on when a big investment is made, or being more local, holding back on filling vacancies. So if you know, I don't know, you're going to get self-checkouts in your store and you've got lots of vacancies, probably prudent not to fill them all, because the reality will be your cashiering budget at some point will change because there'll be lots of people serving themselves. So that kind of local knowledge and also forewarning. So as we said at the start, you need a kind of continual plan, hence why it's called continuous improvement. I know in the book, Sue, you did a section on productivity roadmaps in this chapter. Do you want to explain that in a bit more detail?
Yeah, productivity roadmap is really setting out the savings plan for the future 3 to 5 years. So that will require a mix of quick wins, but it then allows for the fact that things like IT investment can often be over multiple years, or some rollouts can take longer. It also allows you to be looking ahead to new technology, new ways of doing things. There might be, you know, there's often enablers that have to happen in a business before you can release the value. So by projecting ahead to thinking, well, actually, when I know this new piece of core IT kit comes in, I'll then be able to do this project. Well, that's going to fall in year 25, 26, and that's where the value is. So most businesses are projecting ahead in terms of creating a long-term savings plan, because they do know that they're going to have to reinvest into whether it's salary, new services, new products, you know, protecting the profit margin for the business.
And again, that's when you then revalidate with more efficiency study to make sure you've closed the loop and you've not increased downtime inadvertently.
Yeah. So it's a great way of kind of having something on. Usually you can fit it on kind of a sheet of paper if you're being old fashioned, or on a spreadsheet, but something that very simply sets out, this is where we think the priorities are. And the great thing is it then allows you to really focus on what matters. There's always, I know from my time in operations teams, there's always new ideas and something you could be chasing. Knowing I've got to deliver that chunk for that year allows you to really make sure you keep your priorities, because there's always a million and one things that want to take your attention.
Yeah, and National Living Wage will drive some of that for people, so that will almost create the gap or the need.
Yeah.
Is my guess.
It works really well if you have your productivity plan and you're almost renewing that ahead of your corporate cycle. Because usually what happens in the corporate budgeting cycle, somebody will come to you and say, right, how much can you manage with next year? We want you to take a cut of this much, because that's just the way it always works. Or, well, actually, you've got 10 new outlets, but actually we need to hold the salary top line the same. So if you're in a place where you go into those rounds with a strong evidence base and a strong plan, actually it allows you to be really prepared for those negotiations, as they often are, but actually means you can put a strong case as well. So there's lots of really good reasons for having a productivity roadmap.
Perfect. Well, that sets us up nicely for chapter 4, which we'll discuss in the next episode, about how do I balance investing in sales and controlling costs.